I'm Si, and I'd like to invite you into the Library of Impossible Things. The library is a place where I collect items that Doctor Who fans love, and I collect their stories too. And for this episode, I am delighted to be joined by someone who I have never spoken to before this evening, but whose work I've admired online for some time. It's Mr. Richard Swift. Hello.
Hello, Si. How are you doing?
I am good, thank you. Welcome to the library.
Thank you. I feel like entering into the spirit of this library throughout the next hour of conversation and say, what a lovely library you've got. And it's filling up nicely.
It is, yes. I mean, it's full of people already, so that's, yeah. That's a good thing. So I suppose we better start with me asking you, what's the object you've brought for the library?
Well, Si, I did give this quite some considerable thought. There are lots of items that might come up in conversation that are dear to me from the world of Doctor Who, but I have gone for some shameless self-promotion, really, because the thing which is driving my Doctor Who obsession the most and has been for some years now is the building of Lego Doctor Who models. So for your library, a relatively exclusive item will be a Lego-built Pandorica.
Oh, wow.
Which is the first model that I built with any ambition of putting it on a bookshelf and keeping it there, and became the Twitter account feed that I'd use, Brick Pandorica. It comes with sliding doors. It has an 11th Doctor imprisoned inside, and it is yours for the library in perpetuity.
Fantastic. I was hoping that it would be one of your models. So, and the first one, that's amazing. Thank you. So right. I'm going to ask, how did this mashing up of Doctor Who and Lego come about?
Well, guess Doctor Who and Lego have always been part of my world, really. When I think about the best Saturday afternoons as a child, it was a simple pattern. I played out in the street Saturday morning. My dad would do a kind of English breakfast style lunch, which we were astonishingly allowed to have in the lounge. We would sit and watch Grandstand and whatever Sporting Magnificent was thrown my way. On the carpet in front of me would be Lego. And then eventually, when the final scores had been read out, Doctor Who would appear. And that was just the perfect Saturday of my youth, really. And the two things really started to come back together as I had my own family and Lego started appearing for my children, their shockingly bonkers creative ideas about how they built Lego. We were not great on instructions in the house, and Doctor Who had returned. And when I was thinking, well, what am I going to do with these bricks? Because my kids don't want to play with me anymore. I'm going to build a Doctor Who model. And I fancied building that Pandorica box. That looked easy. It's a nice square cube, relatively simple. So I built it in multicolours, and then I thought, oh, you know, I could probably go online and get those pieces in the right colours. And that slippy slope began. Oh. And you build one and then you build another because you think that's quite a reasonably good use of your leisure time. And then you wake up in 2024 having built literally hundreds of them and have a list of literally hundreds more to build. And no doubt after the new series has aired in a month or so's time, more things will join that list of stuff that I don't want to build. I need to build.
Yeah. Yeah. It's must be interesting how it moves from the want to no, I've got to do this one now.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, it's like all obsessions, you know, we just happen to share one around Doctor Who, but it is that slippy slope. You think that what you're doing in support of the thing that you're interested in is all well and reasonable and measured. And then you wake up years later and you are totally absorbed in that. The great thing for me is that I really like Lego. I really like Doctor Who, and I can bring those two together. So I'm almost getting double the enjoyment whenever I'm building.
So I've got to ask, is there one that has been a real favourite of all the things you've built?
So there are some that have survived.
Yeah,
I don't have limitless resources. I can't buy my way out of building challenges when I'm building Doctor Who Lego. I'm sure if I brought 100 people off the street into my little box room where I keep my bricks the general public would generally be shocked at how much Lego I do have. But in the context of what I'm doing, I have to do what I did when I was a kid, and every so often just take builds apart to create new scenes and, mm-hmm. and new sets. So the ones that have survived tend to be, I think, the really iconic sets like the Tomb of the Cybermen that survived the test of time. Warrior's Gate, which I'm going to be posting soon again. That stood the test of time. And there are some that appeal to me because often I end up building in greys and tans because that's the default colour scheme for a lot of Doctor Who production. So when I get to building something more colourful, that tends to hang around a bit mm-hmm. longer. So a great example of that is the Trickler Cafe from Evil of the Daleks. This was something completely off my radar. You know, it appears in a couple of really grainy telly snaps. And when Doctor Who magazine was starting to do some of its production set articles around lockdown and beyond, and guys like Gav Rymill, and Rhys Williams were doing mock-ups of the sets, suddenly this Trickler Cafe appeared, and I thought, wow, that's a great set. It's a bit bonkers, but it's a great set. And it's not in grey, and it's not in tan, mm-hmm. and it's got complicated diagonals, which sometimes Lego doesn't do particularly well. I'm going to give that a go. So those bright colour shock type models, they tend to have survived. The American Diner is another example of that from Impossible Astronaut. Kept my snake dance, the mouth of the cave in the shape of the snake. That's been a survivor of many a disassembly. I've probably got about 30 or 40, maybe more sets on display. And some of those I've started to take to Lego shows. I did one in Mytham Royd in West Yorkshire at the start of the year. I'm hoping to do one in York this month. Mm-hmm. So some of those bigger sets I've kind of kept as well, with the opportunity of sharing with the general public through those types of events.
Fantastic. It's certainly something that appealed to me. Like you, I was a big Lego fan as a kid. And as an adult, I have managed to buy many high-end sets that I probably can't really afford, but they're so much fun to build. But I can remember my dad built me a wooden TARDIS when I was young, and I didn't have any action figures, but I did have Lego minifigures who would become the Doctor and his companion, and I remember building a console and things like that. So yeah, I can understand completely the attraction between the two, and Doctor Who brings out so much creative stuff within us. You've got to find a channel for it.
I think that's true. And I think the other thing that is true of the Lego system is it explores all of time and space.
Yes.
You know, it has past history. It looks at the contemporary world. It has space elements to it. So almost in Doctor Who, really, there's not an episode, a setting that where I can't get some hook into it through that Lego system. And you know, that's certainly proved to be the case over the last few years. So it works well, I think, from that perspective. And I think the other thing is it's just as legitimate a creative tool as many other Doctor Who fans find through cosplay or by drawing or creating audio ventures. Mm-hmm. All that, the medium creativity is there, and Lego is just another strand of that that just happens to work particularly for the interests that I have. And it takes me away from the screen. You know, if I've been working all day on perpetual teams, the last thing I want to do actually is look at a telly screen, have noise. I just want to break away, do something with my hands. That's a very solitary activity, and that gives me a lot of pleasure, you know.
Yeah, there is something about putting Lego bricks together that is very mindful, I think.
Yes, and unlike DIY, where I do something with my hands to build something and it simply falls apart or ruins my house or causes £100 of damage, the Lego system is reliable in its buildability, breakability and robustness that I can't actually do any harm. It generally does what I ask it to, and that's a pleasant thing for my mind.
Yeah, it's just you've got to ask it to do that. That's the thing. Yeah. So that's Lego. So the other question, of course, is where did your journey with Doctor Who start? How did you discover the show?
Well, like many of your guests, a lot of it is an age thing. Where were you at that particular age in life? When I was 4 years old, I was round at my neighbour's house, and my neighbours had five kids. They're all older than me. I looked up to them. They were the people I wanted to be when I grew up another year or 2 years or what have you. And they were a really welcoming family. I just make it my home, wander in anytime I wanted, and always welcomed. And then there was one day when I went into their living room, and there was a bit of a panic broke out, and these kids were ushering me out. He said, you can't come in here. There's a scary program on the telly. I said, oh, come on. You know, let us watch. And they said, no, it's not appropriate for you. It's called Doctor Who. And the way I remember it is I kind of left the house feeling just humbled that, you know, I wasn't old enough to play with these kids that I looked up to. And the root of that was that I would be too scared by the show Doctor Who. So I resolved in my mind that I'm going to watch this show. And the way I played out in my mind, the next opportunity to watch Doctor Who was Robot. Great starting point. First Tom Baker, as you know. And that was it. It was like the starting pistol going off for Doctor Who watching. I was in from day one. Mm-hmm. The curious thing about this story is that I didn't quite believe my own story for a long, long time, in that it wasn't credible to me that at 4 years old, I would be ushered out of a living room and then for a long period of time hold on to the idea that I was going to watch this program and that I would have been aware that it was coming back on. And then only about 3-4 months ago, listening to a podcast that was covering the Planet of Spiders omnibus edition.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be shown the day before Robot was shown.
Of course, yes. So
all of a sudden, this story going on in my head that I was slightly skeptical about turned out to fall into place. I got ushered out of the repeat of Planet of the Apes, Planet of Spiders at Christmas time. And the very next day, to prove my bravery to the street, I watched Robot, and that was it. In.
And like you say, that is a brilliant story to start off with.
it is bizarre. And bizarre, as I say, because it took me so long to actually reconcile it in my mind, I guess. And then I was in. I remember the way the seasons fell that year. Terror of the Zygons came out, I think, at the end of summer, because it was a quick follow-on series. And I remember being at a friend's of the family's house. And naturally, Saturday afternoon, Doctor Who was starting up again. This was my time. And there was a suggestion that Doctor Who was not appropriate for the children in that house. I remember... And again, I don't come well out of this story, but I do remember throwing the tantrum of all tantrums in this house. And eventually the seriousness of the situation hit home for our hosts. And I was allowed into the living room on my own to watch Terror of the Zygons. So it was really a lightning fast take for me in terms of this is the show for me. It's absolutely the one. And, you know, it just went on and on from there in terms of watching. Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the themes that will come out from this discussion is how important family has played throughout my life with Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. And what I felt at the time when I was sort of 5-6 years of age was there were people within my family who really understood that I viewed something magical about this program. So in terms of my mum got me the Weetabix. We must have been overeating Weetabix during the time that the cards and the little board games were on offer. She made sure that I'd got Doctor Who and the Monsters book one Christmas, and you know, I'd never heard of this book until I unwrapped it Christmas morning. What a great entry point, what a good kids reference book to have at that time to start to absorb yourself in terms of there's not just the Doctor that I've seen so far, but there's all this history to go at. And these are those amazing black and white pictures from the previous eras of Doctor Who. Absolutely wonderful. The other person who cottoned on to all my interests in life I had a great aunt. She was a spinster who lived in Old Swan in Liverpool, which is where I grew up at the time. And yeah, she must have been in her 70s. She'd retired. We'd go many Sunday afternoons, and she would ensure that the football highlights were on telly, which was brilliant. That was one of my key interests. Mm-hmm. She would buy me a comic book, which was my first access into comics and definitely not my last. She gave me Pippin and Playhow, which was a kind of BBC licensed Mr. Men Trumpton type anthology comic. And she would produce without fail Typhoo, T, Doctor Who cards every time I went round. Now, I don't know what the average tea consumption is of a 70-year-old woman in Old Swan in Liverpool, but it wasn't tantamount to the number of Typhoo cards that used to appear. And I just have this vision of her rallying her neighbours on her street, rallying her friends in the neighbourhood to say, I have this 6-7-year-old child who likes nothing more than football, comics and Doctor Who. I can give him football. I can give him comics. Come on, drink your Typhoo tea up. I need your cards. I think there are only about 10 or 12 in the set, but every week without fail, it was just about, you know, people identifying what your passion is and willing to run with it for you. And those are really good memories from around that time.
Well, that sounds it. That's a wonderful thing to do. I mean, I'm fairly lucky that I had a mum who quite indulged my love of the show sort of fairly early on. I don't think my dad ever has quite reconciled the fact that his son is a Doctor Who fan and still takes the piss now. So, but yeah, I mean, that family influence plays a big part, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, look, my dad's similar to yours. I would think that it's all a bit of a mystery, this Lego stuff and this Doctor Who stuff, and he humours it to a point. But for him, he and I have had football, and that drives us to similar levels of obsession and over-talking, and is a easy way into a conversation and an easy way to experience things in life. So, you know, there are different aspects to those relationships. But for me, as I say, there were one or two people in my family who really flew the flag for that interest. And the other thing was, I'm talking to a librarian here, libraries have stood me in such good stead in terms of my interest in Doctor Who. And when I was 7, I went to a new school in Liverpool, and the library was rammed full of those initial sort of dozen target books. And shamelessly, again, I would always pick a Doctor Who book to read from that library. And it automatically, a bit like the Monster book, it automatically moved Doctor Who away from simply being a television program that was on every Saturday afternoon to being something that could be enjoyed all the time and had adventures beyond what I had seen. And, you know, those early Target books, Web of Fear, in particular, Green Death, just absolutely fired my imagination, possibly more than the TV show did, because the TV show was so fleeting in those early days. You know, that was 25 minutes and you're done. And as I say, those books just expanded the excitement out over and over and over again. And, you know, whichever person was involved in purchasing books for that very modest school library, wow, they curated that well, from my perspective anyway. And and as I say, it was another one of those like building blocks of Doctor Who fandom that came at a really early age.
Yeah, I mean, like you, the books were my second gateway into the show, really. More the history of the show suddenly coming alive, and all these stories were alive in my head just from having them read to me and then sort of reading them myself. It just expanded my imagination so much.
Yes, and I think the Target book was the first bit of Doctor Who merchandise that got my pocket money. I remember buying Invisible Enemy at a Woolworths, which in itself dates the I remember going to the shop. It was probably a trade-off between a small box of Lego or a Doctor Who book. They had loads on display, as I remember. The Invisible Enemy would have been a really contemporary story at that point in time, and it must have made such a huge impression on me as being, you know, one of the best I'd seen, that I absolutely snapped it up. And whilst I did end up buying quite a lot of Target books, I wasn't quite in the completist vein, and I didn't quite stick with the series to its conclusion. Certainly I had quite a few, and they were the, you know, the books I took on holiday with me, and I have hugely positive memories of them. And you know, occasionally I'll pick up and read one. I read Image of the Fandal recently. I read The Daleks ahead of the Vought Vought coming out, the DVD coming out at Christmas. And you know, the truth is, they're a good read. They are a really good read. The standard of the storytelling, even when it sticks almost verbatim to the shooting script, still it is such an enjoyable thing to have a couple of hours to yourself reading.
Oh, absolutely. I always find there's such comfort in Terence Dix's wonderful phrases that come back time and time again. Obviously, there's the wheezing, groaning sound, but there's the Doctor with his capacious pockets and his extraordinarily long scarf and his vaguely bohemian. See, all of these things I could just rattle off without thinking about them, because I read those books over and over again, and they're so comfortable. Mm. And it's just like seeing an old friend that you haven't seen for a while, and you just know what's coming, and it's really great.
Yeah, and the reality is that many of our memory cheats of the programs that we watched when we were a kid are brought about by actually being superseded by the Target novels and where they embellish stories.
And yes,
when you eventually get to see, or when eventually I got to see, the pre-Tom Baker stories on television, a lot of them I judged against what I had read in the Target novels. And we talked about Green Death just now, Web of Fear, though I had to wait a long time with everything else to
was worth that. The wait, fortunately.
Yes, but very much my benchmark for how good is this TV story was guided by how much I enjoyed the Target novel.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone in that one at all.
I'm sure I'm not. The other thing I wanted to say about when I was sort of 6-7 was I'm pleased that some of your previous guests have talked about a period where Doctor Who had some credibility in the playground, where there were people they could enact Doctor Who with. That was at school with them. I have to say I'm an outlier here. There was never a stage during my schooling in which Doctor Who was in any way the cool thing to do.
And oh, no.
In the mid-70s, I would say Space 1999 and Star Trek ruled. The comic book that got passed around the playground was Lookin'. Space 1999, apart from football highlights, I think was about the only show I was allowed to watch on ITV. And that was, I'm sure, as a consequence of loving Doctor Who. And so I would huddle around this Lookin' magazine to find out what was happening actually that week on Moonbase Alpha. And then we would create comic books and we would enact stories in the playground. And if we ran out of Space 1999 adventures, Star Trek would kick in. Mm-hmm. Not Doctor Who just didn't, irrespective of what was in the school library, it did not get a look in whatsoever. And and that was the pattern for pretty much all my school days. Sadly, there was always something cooler on television that attracted the attention in the playground, or became the subject of adventures in the playground, or you know, with toys at home, or what have you. And it was a bit of a shame, but it, to an extent, that allowed me to make Doctor Who as personal and shape it as much as I wanted to. There were absolutely no other influences that said, this is how you need to enjoy this show. This is how you need to express your enjoyment of this show. It was something that outside of the hustle and bustle of friendships and school and activity was a quiet place I could go to and really feel comfortable in terms of loving something as much as I have with Doctor Who.
Well, that's not a bad thing overall, really.
I think it's a positive thing. I think it's a positive thing if it's if it's a solitary activity rather than a lonely activity.
And yes, I think for me, that's the difference.
Yeah, that dial has always been on the solitary side rather than the, well, I don't know anyone, I don't talk to anyone, what I've got left is Doctor Who. It's a choice. It's a choice of what I do when I take myself away to do something for myself.
Wow. That is absolutely fair enough. And that seems quite a sorted way of looking at it to me.
Yes. I'll give you an extreme example of solitary Doctor Who-ness. I was about 10 years ago, for sake of argument, working for an organisation that would ping me all over the place for a couple of days of office work, so London, Edinburgh, which is relatively easy from West Yorkshire. And then every so often I'd be sent to Cardiff. And Cardiff, whether you're on the train or on a in the car, is a 5 hours there and 5 hours back. And when you're trying to do that in the day because somebody absolutely must have you face-to-face with them, a 10-hour round trip is utter ball ache. And what would happen is I would choose a train, I'd get to Cardiff Central Station, bundle out to the office, which is about a couple of hundred yards from the station, do my endless face-to-face meetings, hurry back to station and disappear. And somewhere in my head, I wasn't really thinking of Cardiff as being an opportunity to pay homage to Doctor Who in any way, shape or form. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of these trips, I'm going down on a train, get to about Bristol, phone starts pinging with messages. There's some mini crisis at work and my meetings are falling out of my diary. So I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this is a 10-hour round trip here that looks like being utterly wasted. So I managed to salvage a couple of meetings in an office that I didn't used to go to in Cardiff, get off at the station, get in a taxi, go to this office, wherever it is outside the town centre, and have a couple of meetings. And then, you know, there was literally nobody available to speak to me. So I thought, okay, right, I'll go get a sandwich. I walk out the door of this office and it's all a typically modern office-y type area. And facing me is this ludicrously small brown road sign with a picture of a Dalek on it. And it was like coming out of a fog. I suddenly thought, I'm in Cardiff. They're showing me a road sign to a Dalek. It's lunchtime. It's midweek. It's pouring with rain. However, if I follow this magical path, at the very least, there might be the Doctor Who Experience shop open or something.
Yeah.
Pick up a sandwich on the way. So anyway, 5 minutes later, there is Doctor Who Experience in front of me. And I'm thinking, God, you know, I'd been to the one in London with my brother. We'd had a great day out. It'd been like being on the tube in the Experience. There were so many people packed in. It was just like everybody's elbows, everyone was panic. Couldn't really see what's going on. But it would have been a fun day out. So I thought, wow, I wonder, maybe it's not just the shop that will be open. Maybe, actually, I can do the Experience. So I get there, walk in, everything's open. Brilliant. I've got no meetings. I'm going to do this. Here's my money. Doctor Who Experience, please, for me. Gets to my time slot a few minutes later. Doors open. You go in, cinema, cracked cinema screen type trick thing goes on. I'm the only one in there. So up comes the crack in the wall, and I'm into whatever that, I think might have been a TARDIS interior, was the first room you walk into. I'm on my own. And bless the member of staff at the Doctor Who Experience on that rainy midweek day in Cardiff. This person was up for giving me the full experience. We're going to be excited together. We're going to do this. Panic. Oh, this is happening. That's happening. The other thing's happening. I'm thinking, God, this is monumentally embarrassing. I just want to have the breathing space of not having somebody's armpit in my face and actually see some of these props and do some of these great things. But neither of us could quite resolve breaking the silence on, actually, it'd just be better if we just walk around here and have a really good time. So I did the whole Doctor Who Experience as a solitary customer, spill out the other end to the props, which was brilliant because I had the run of the place. I could take my time. It was just me. But if anything summed up that balance between, has Doctor Who been a collective experience for me, or has it just been a bit of a one person, do it my way experience, was summed up by that rainy lunchtime in Cardiff many years ago.
That's a brilliant story. And it's just the fact that everyone was just too polite to say, do you know what? we don't have to do this. It's fine.
No. I mean, it just never happened. Our eyes never quite met in that way across the TARDIS console.
So how did your fandom progress? So obviously we've had your younger days. So as a teenager and sort of beyond, how did you have a break from the show?
Well, my brother created a bit of an issue. We were on telly family. We were definitely not a video recorder family. So my brother sided with Buck Rogers, Battlestar Galactica, and Robin of Sherwood. So he would go to my aunt's house and he would watch that on her telly, and I would watch Doctor Who, and then somehow the family would be brought together at a later point. Friends at school again. I had one friend, Ben, who was a Target book reader, and he had the Blake 7 videos. And we were united for our interest in those things and in interesting comic books. But I don't think necessarily we brought the best out of each other in terms of genuine friendship. I think we were interested in the same things, but we looked at those things in a very different way. So what was turning my attention, I think, when I was a teenager was I was very into comic books, and that wave of comic creators that in truth came with Doctor Who Weekly. And, you know, Dave Gibbons's, Alan Moore's, Steve Dillon, David Lloyd, they were becoming the British artists that were part of that invasion of American comics at that time. And the, you know, the Swamp Thing and the Sandman ultimately, and V for Vendetta. So as a teenager in the 80s for me, I was loyal to the television program in terms of watching it on television, but the momentum was all with my interest in American comics. And that seemed to be growing up, in inverted commas, perhaps in a slightly New Adventures kind of a way of growing up. That was growing up as I was growing up. So it wasn't that I turned my back on Doctor Who, but my interests and my pocket money were going on American comic books. There were loads of shops opening up. By this time, I was living down south in London, loads of comic shops on my doorstep. They were selling off Marvel Monster Comics, Jack Kirby, Captain America comics for like 5p and 10p. It was an absolute steal. And I was just absorbing all these absolutely fantastic comic books. I think I stopped buying Doctor Who Monthly about that time because the priority was American comics. But I'm glad to say that despite being a cynical 15, 16 year old and looking slightly dimly at the Sixth Doctor adventures, I never gave up. I maintained that lifeline with the program. And it kept a lot of my merchandise, a close second for what should I bring to the library? And I hope somebody brings it at a later point with a Doctor Who Viewmasters.
Oh, yes.
That was modern technology. That was my virtual reality. And specifically, the full circle one, the first reel, the first picture of the first reel is in Gong. You go, you don't.
It's the TARDIS, isn't it, with the Doctor and Ramona and K9. I know the very picture because I spent hours looking at that picture.
And there we go. And I would hold on to things like that. And that is exactly what I did. I would stare through that Viewmaster at that picture to the point where it became impossible that I was not stood in that console room with Romana and K9 and the Fourth Doctor. So there was still that loving nostalgia, I think, for the show as a teenager. I recognised its huge importance to me throughout my childhood. I wasn't, as I say, I wasn't abandoning it. I did also persuade my parents to buy me a VHS Doctor Who story, despite the fact I had no access to a video recorder.
That's a very Doctor Who fan thing to do.
Yeah. I thought it'd be a good investment for the future, and it was no doubt an eye-watering amount of money. And I plumped for Talon's Wing Chiang, which, although it has its notoriety at the time, I remember it as being the scariest of the Doctor Who's I wanted. I was very rarely spooked out by Doctor Who. Sapphire and Steel used to scare me beyond belief. But Doctor Who, I was generally quite level-headed about it. But Talons of Weng Chiang, there are two or three set pieces in that. The one where the Fourth Doctor foolishly decides to go on stage of the theatre, the point in which Leela looks like she's going to be burnt to a crisp under the theatre. This was just, frankly, more than I could handle. And so that got my vote for the video that I wanted the most. And, you know, in the hope that at some point in my future, video recorders would become a thing I had access to. So those are the kind of things that were going on in my teenage years. I think I was 17, 18 when The Seventh Doctor really started to kind of pull my attention back in. I thought Remembrance of the Daleks was great, but Greatest Show in the Galaxy absolutely lit me up again. I remember being at my nan's house and it was kind of in the middle of a meal and I was really pushing my luck to have it on in the corner of my eye from the other room. And I just got up and went and sat and said, this is unmissable television. This is absolutely unmissable television. It felt like that core DNA of Doctor Who that had wrestled my attention all those years ago. And I was feeling really back in at that point. However, my world was going to change because I'd finished secondary school and managed to arrange a year abroad living with another family in the United States. And off I went to do a senior year at high school and embrace all those magnificent things about high school life, some of which I'd seen in films and didn't think was real, and some of the things that turned out real that I thought should have been in movies. And it was a very small town place, quite sleepy in many respects. But I'd made my mind up that, you know, this was the chance to embrace myself fully in the culture of small town New England America. And, you know, no access to really anything in the UK. I'd have a reverse charges call to my parents once a week and that was it. About a couple of weeks into being there, I was flicking through the monstrously large TV listings magazine and I noticed that we could get two PBS channels, one from New York State and one from Vermont, both showing Doctor Who. One a late night on a Saturday omnibus and another one on a Sunday morning omnibus. And that obviously piqued my interest. The other thing was that the family I was staying with, absolutely wonderful family who I owe them a great debt of gratitude for taking me on for a whole year. They were devout churchgoers. And one of the things that they made clear was that they weren't going to impose Sunday service and all the events that went with that. I would be left alone in the house. And I'd gone from a house with a younger brother to a house with four other teenage kids in there. So there was always hustle and bustle in the house. And on a Sunday, thanks to organized religion, I had the house to myself. And this was going to be the point every week where I would omnibus Doctor Who. Again, it's back to that. What do I choose to do in solitude? Mm-hmm. My Sunday morning worship for a year in a small town in New England was as much Doctor Who omnibus action as I could squeeze into a Sunday morning. And I did look, I can't remember what the website is that tells you when Doctor Who was on at any time in the world ever. I have looked it up and they don't list actually what episodes these two stations were choosing.
Oh, no.
Which is a shame. And I didn't, for somebody who is known for the odd list or two, it's not something I actually wrote down either. But my memory of it is that they pretty much cycled through all colour Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And they were on separate cycles. And there was occasional black and white Doctor Who, but the memory cheat could be that that was still Pertwee's or something.
Have been at that time.
But one thing I discovered, and, you know, I think a lot of people who are listening will have had that moment where they suddenly got access to UK Gold or they suddenly got access to, you know, maybe recently on iPlayer. It was overwhelming. It was genuinely overwhelming for me, having had it limited to 25 minutes or 45 minutes at best once a week, the idea that I was trying to get through two omnibuses worth of Doctor Who on a Sunday morning was just too much.
Yes.
It, like, too much of a good thing. So I limited myself to the Fourth Doctor stories because I felt that I wanted to see if these were really as good as my memory of childhood taught me they would be. And the Third Doctor ones because I was so in love with the Target books at the time that felt like, actually, again, are these going to be as good as those Target books were that were imprinted in my mind? By and large, I could get through 8 episodes in a morning if I could. And I didn't try and watch them during the rest of the week because other people wanted the television and I didn't want it as anything other than just me with the television. But what it did do at that point when people were beginning to hit the wilderness years in the UK was it absolutely sent my interest in Doctor Who back up to the levels.
Okay.
I absolutely was thrilled with the fact that the Tom Baker episodes were not letting me down. My memory was not cheating me. My childhood was good. I did have these stories. I did have these adventures. And I still had this passion for those characters. And for the John Pertwee ones, an utter revelation. I'm not a great fan of favourites these days. I've kind of worn out of having favourite things. But I can guarantee as a 19-year-old, I returned to the UK thinking, John Pertwee, the Third Doctor, is my favourite Doctor. There's never going to be an era of Doctor Who that surpasses what I have just seen. And that opinion hasn't lasted, but it was a thrill. And to have that one slice of home during that year abroad being Doctor Who and nothing else was just serendipity beyond, I think.
That you found two stations showing it at the same time was, yeah.
To top that, also, I think I saw season 26 for the first time when I was out there. And I think that was on Canadian television because we were right on the Canadian border and we could pick up Canadian channels. So I didn't miss out on season 26. And the other interesting thing, at least to me, about season 26 watching it that way is it was the first season of Doctor Who I'd been able to watch concurrently with old Doctor Who.
Oh,
so that
yes.
The feeling that I had about Greatest Show in the Galaxy, having a really solid rooted DNA in the Doctor Who of my youth, I finally got that side by side comparison between season 26 and what was going on in the Third and Fourth Doctor eras. And it just felt like the same show. Just absolutely felt seamlessly like the same show. And perhaps if I'd watched it sequentially, I wouldn't have that same feeling about how the classic series ended up.
No, it's entirely possible, isn't it? Obviously, you've got the lovely Pertwee Years homage to start season 26 with, which is perfect timing, really, for you.
Yes, the Brigadier, indeed.
With Battlefield.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah, that was peak Doctor Who watching. And I think I got spoilt that year because when I came back to be a student with not much pennies to scratch together, and they were generally prioritised towards going out and drinking beer. I then fell back into, Simon, libraries.
Ah, right. So yes.
The library in town was building up a nice collection of VHS cassettes. Somebody in the awful hole of a house I was living in had brought a video recorder with them. And that was just... I was so hungry. I was focused on the Hartnell and Troughton stories that era. I was hungry to go back even further after the experiences of the PBS material. And the library, I particularly remember some of those early years tapes, the Daleks story, The Chase, Romans, War Machines was another video I remember getting out endlessly, Seeds of Death. I was really taken by... First and Second Doctor during that period. Couldn't get enough. And it was to the point where it was almost worth repeat watching those stories than necessarily picking up a later story that the library had managed to put on its shelf. And also, I think generally they were always available in the library, not many people getting those out. But the library furnished me with those. the 60s, 70s and 80s hardback books. Those really beautifully illustrated dips back in time for Doctor Who. The Doctor Hand books were readily available. I was just in a constant churn. It was one in, one out. I took one back and one came back out with me. And again, at university, I knew people who were devoted fans of Hammer horror. I knew people who were kind of Star Trek sympathizers at a time when Next Generation and DS9 were starting. And, you know, I watched those shows and I was quite happy to dip in and out of Hammer films. But that elusive Doctor Who friend just simply never happened. It never, you know, the local comic shop, which was in the town, that was obviously full of people who liked comic books. I ended up starting a football team through customers of the comic book shop, but not a sniff of Doctor Who fandom, unfortunately.
It's weird, isn't it? Because you'd think there would be someone somewhere that you would cross over with in all those different places and experiences.
Or as this is very much an in the psychiatrist chair session that you're leading me through, Si, here. my desire to enjoy it purely as a single person activity, perhaps I just ignored it. I ignored those telltale signs that there were people there who were desperate to talk about Doctor Who over a pint, and I was just blinkered and walking through them. Who knows? We will never know.
No. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing, we can't go back and find out, can we, for you? No. So.
And the wilderness years, as they're called, I struggle with that phrase, wilderness years, in the sense that my consumption of Doctor Who was never higher during that period. I don't know, you know, for you and some of the stories that people have told on this, that was a real excuse, wasn't it? Just to, whether it was the books that were coming out, whether it was to access the videos, lucky people who had satellite. It was just there. If you wanted it, you could have it in huge quantity. You weren't scratching around with a Viewmaster reel, a book of monsters, and some Typhoon tea cards. You had it. You had it, and it was brilliant. It was, fandom was being propelled. Just because it wasn't on television, almost made no difference at that period of time for me and in terms of my relationship with the show.
No, I was absolutely the same. That I saw more Doctor Who in 1990 than I'd ever seen. So in a year up to that point, new Doctor Who, that was old Doctor Who. So by stumbling across someone with a pile of several generation down VHS stories that I never thought I would get to see. And it was just suddenly this huge awakening that the history of Doctor Who was suddenly becoming available that I never thought I would see.
Yeah. And occasionally I'd buy stuff. I was buying the Classic Comics magazine at the time, but that was part of that. You know, still comics were a really big part of my interest at that point in time. And it was, you know, I didn't really have any exposure to Doctor Who comics before Doctor Who Weekly. So seeing those in generally mixed standards of storytelling, but it was really interesting.
Variable.
Really interesting. The other things that I was kind of spending what pennies I had on at the time were things like Doctor Who Bulletin, when there was a special issue. I remember the one where the Tomb of Cybermen got returned, and I made sure that I bought that. And it was occasional purchase like that, but mostly I was reliant on public libraries. And, you know, I know it's a tragedy that libraries seem to be struggling and low down the list of resources that we can spend money on as a public purse. And, you know, there are lots of things like the internet that come along that have the functionality of a library, but that curation and that ability to, irrespective of who you are, how wealthy you were, was able to fuel your imagination and give you access to material that was out of reach at the time for me, is just a wonderful thing to reflect on. And, you know, I hope in whatever shape or format, you know, people who are growing up with fandom and discovering shows like Doctor Who today have those same equivalents. iPlayer is doing some of that at the moment, but there's a wealth of other material that I'm sure it'd be lovely that people would be able to access in the style of the Library of Impossible Things.
Absolutely. Having most of my library career was actually in public libraries. I know the power that the library can have. And I also remember the day that I was absolutely delighted when a kid came into the library and he said, "I've got to do some homework and I need some help. My homework is about the history of Doctor Who." And it was just like, that's homework. That's just fun. I said, "Well, you've come to the right person. Let me help you with this." But I could find him the reference books to help him with that, and all of that. It was incredible. And this was sort of, it must have been 2013, because I think it was around the 50th. So the schools were studying, actively studying Doctor Who, which was just mind-blowing to me. And then being able to help someone with something that you love and pass that on and say, "Come and ask me any questions you want to, I'm quite happy to help," was an amazing thing. And I think about how I pestered the librarian in my local library when I was young to get the Peter Haining books that I couldn't afford, because I was desperate to read them and make sure they were all ordered in and things like that. It was just like history repeating. It was wonderful.
Oh, indeed. That's a wonderful story. How did the boy explain away your handwriting when...
Well, I'm not quite sure he got away with that, but but yeah, I mean, just the fact to mix my two loves of sort of libraries and Doctor Who was such a magical moment. I dined out on that to my fan friends for a long time, and yes, then we were all there and said, "If only we'd had Doctor Who homework, we'd have aced it. We'd have done so well."
I do remember I guess O-level English literature, I did an assignment on the power of a paradox, and I used The Day of the Daleks, which is one of my favourite, easily back when I had favourites, one of my favourite target novels. And I don't think the choice of Day of the Daleks went down particularly well with my English teacher. I assume that my argument around the clever use of paradox was absolutely stunning and worthy of great praise, but no, it didn't go down very well. So I did try it.
I tend to find that teachers had a very low opinion of Doctor Who and Doctor Who books at school.
Yeah. Yes. Despite, as many people have said, you know, the target novels, you know, launched my reading. Absolutely, totally, and utterly, you know, and it led to Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury and lots of other fantastic self-chosen home time, own time reading material, you know. And if it hadn't been for those target novels, I probably wouldn't have kicked on into those more respectable corners of science fiction.
Well, yeah, well, it made me a voracious reader, that, and I still pick up anything and will read anything to this day because of those Doctor Who books that I was just so desperate to read, and then it becomes a habit and you never quite lose it.
No, I totally agree. Totally agree. So the wilderness years, I mean, became the non-wilderness years, didn't they?
Oh, yes.
I warned you ahead of time that family would play a key part in this, and the start of the new series was the start of my family.
My
daughter was born a few months before the new series came out. By a bizarre coincidence, her middle name was Rose, but that genuinely is a coincidence. And amongst all the hullabaloo and the hopes and fears for Doctor Who's return was slightly overshadowed by the fact that I was a father completely lost at sea at what all this parenthood malarkey was about. When Rose, the episode, was being shown, that was right in the middle of bed routine, which seemed to be really important to me at that point in time. You know, my daughter would not grow up to be a reasonable, sane human being if she didn't go to bed at a certain specific time. I'd bought a DVD recorder to celebrate the start of Doctor Who, and my need to keep this in absolutely the most up-to-date, futuristic condition that I could. And so I nervously, because I didn't really believe technology works in my house, nervously setting that to record Rose. And I remember just watching the pre-title sequence with the alarm clock and the running around to the department store type stuff and seeing the opening titles kick in. And that was enough for me. That was enough to calm the nerves that I had that the show I loved was going to be an absolute flop. And the thought that I could be ostracized for Doctor Who any more than I was already worried about just vanished at that mm-hmm. moment in time. Those looming billboards that said, "Wow, Richard, you are heading for real trouble here with this. Everyone's going to watch this," type moment, was just allayed by that opening few minutes. And I was absolutely back into this is Doctor Who, and fair play to that production team, fair play to Russell T. Davis. They absolutely made it, and they made it in a way that has absolute continuity. And mm-hmm. when I look at, you know, in hindsight, when I flow through from Curse of Fenric and Survival into Rose and some of those opening series episodes, despite the gulf in time and the advancements in terms of CGI technology and all those kind of distracting elements of watching the show, it feels remarkably smooth, that move between the two. There've been bigger jumps for me between things like the end of the War Games, the start of Spearhead from Space, bigger leaps in tone and style than there were between what I remember from season 26 into season one. It's just unbelievable, really, for me. There was never a shred of doubt once that appeared on my screen that this was the show I loved. And what that meant then was, whilst I did watch it sort of on my own for the first sort of 4 or 5 years, all of a sudden there were other people in this house, a family.
Oh, yes.
Available to watch a family program.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of programs we watch as a family. But my daughter caught up sometime around the Matt Smith era, that 11th Hour, and Amy as a character that she could identify with came at exactly the right time for her.
Yeah.
My son, who we'll no doubt talk quite a bit about, he came along, and after a couple of false starts around Idiot's Lantern, I remember being quite a difficult sell, Shakespeare Code being one that absolutely spooked him out. By the time we got to the 50th anniversary, we were watching as a four, and we continue mm-hmm. through their teenage years to watch new Doctor Who as the four of us. We settled down on Boxing Day morning in various states of consciousness to watch watch Church on Ruby Road, and it has become a real family thing.
Oh, how wonderful.
And that's lovely, absolutely lovely.
Yeah.
My son, you know, I talked about my dad and I having sport. We'd go to football matches, go to rugby matches. We'd sit on the sofa and watch sport. It's an easy way into a conversation that leads on to other conversations. And, you know, I'm lucky enough that my father's still around, lucky enough that we're still able to go and enjoy sport together. We kick footballs around the back garden endlessly. As my children, for some reason, I don't know what genetic error occurred, no interest in sport whatsoever. I kicked as many balls around this house mm-hmm. this evening as I could, and they would just look to me like I'm an absolute idiot. But my son, similarly, Doctor Who has sparked. So we watched the new series, utterly absorbed. Again, hats off to Russell T. Davis and the current production team. Sarah Jane Adventures came at just the right time for him. Mm-hmm. I love Sarah Jane Adventures myself, but for him, you know, 6-7 years age, that was perfect television.
Yeah.
And it inseparable for him than the experience of watching Doctor Who, the main show. So when he was about 9, the transition from Sarah Jane Adventures to some of the Fourth Doctor Sarah Jane Adventures was a relatively short sell for me.
Yeah.
So we watched a couple of those, Pyramids of Mars, what have you. And he said, "Well, let's just watch them. Let's watch Doctor Who." So we settled on starting from Spearhead from Space, just as a concession to colour television, yeah. I suppose. And we chipped away at it. And in the back of my head is thinking, yeah, he liked it at 9. He liked it at 10 years old. Well, maybe he might not like it at 11. Might not, might like it at 12. And there was no, it was a pilgrimage of sorts, but it happened in fits and starts as real life got in the way of watching these things. He really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was a bonding experience for the two of us. I wasn't, you know, never watched these episodes with another person before.
Yeah.
But also, I found myself watching these episodes with a very positive frame of mind. Some of it willing this not to end as a shared experience, but some of it also seeing it through his eyes, seeing it through the excitement of a young person watching these classic episodes and somebody who was embracing the rough around the edges elements of those stories. So this kept progressing on and on. And I was also thinking conscious of, well, what age was I when I started to think, you know, I've got other things that are distracting me. I'm going to keep watching it, but it's not quite, you know, we were heading towards the Sixth Doctor. So when we got to the Five Doctors, I said, let's take a break from this and let's give Blake Seven a go.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I thought, you know, very much Blake Seven and Doctor Who felt like they existed in the same universe. They had very much similar production values, as you know, similar special effects, similar kind of that buy-in that you have to make to a television program. I think this is one of the reasons why I build with Lego Doctor Who. I see people cosplay. I see people do books and, you know, drawings and stuff. I think there's a pact you make with Doctor Who, which is, it really asks you as a viewer, if you're going to dedicate yourself, to fill in some creative gaps along the way.
Definitely, yes.
So you're driven to be a active viewer who is being creative. The spillover into thinking of those stories when you're walking down the street, or thinking of your own stories down the street, or wanting to absorb yourself in a land of bricks that looks like and resembles on the show. Mm-hmm. I don't think it is that big a gap. And I think there's something about Doctor Who that absolutely takes that to the next degree, more than the Star Treks and the Star Warses and whatever that have fandoms that also are creative. Doctor Who, in its makeup, in its DNA, really attracts that. And Blake Seven falls into that category. You have to make an effort, I think, to really embrace the full-on bonkersness of that show, the bitching, the one-liners, the crazy costumes, the woolly stories. And he bought into that as well. We watched the 52 as a complete run. I was slightly shocked that he wasn't completely overwhelmed by the final episode, as I had been as a kid. Many a closet Blake Seven fan came out in the playground the day after that final episode.
I bet, yes.
We didn't quite have that moment. But again, it was another great, great TV show to share with you. And then when we got to the Sixth Doctor, which I was slightly cautious about, he absolutely bought into it. And by this time, you know, he's 15, 16. He has a critical eye. He is...
Yeah.
Full on interest in drama and English literature. He has a real opinion about these things, but he is seeing things through the generation of his day. It's, you know, an episode will end and it's, Dad, I think we need to talk about some of the things that we unfortunately saw in there, that you know, things that potentially are lost to me, but meet the attitudes of the day, as they say.
Yes.
So that's been just a wonderful experience. And when, bizarrely, when we got to Survival about a year ago, I was really mournful, more mournful for the end than I had been sort of 89, 90, in the sense that Doctor Who had ended, but I was off to have new adventures. I was off student life. I could access old Doctor Who if I wanted to. It didn't feel at that time like a great loss. But I think this time around, getting to Survival, it felt like, oh, well, so what are me and my son William going to do now? what are we going to watch? And also because I was seeing things through my older eyes and his younger eyes, and really, really enjoying the Seventh Doctor and Ace stories, it also felt like it had reached an untimely end. I wasn't prepared, as I had in previous years, to accept that that was going to be the end of the Cartmel era, the Seventh Doctor era. Yeah. So that was nice. It allowed me to reappraise stories that perhaps I might have stuck to my traditional opinions of. But the bit about feeling like, oh, well, that's it for me and my son is obviously nonsense. And we, you know, we're cycling through a bit of 60s Who at the moment. It was Aztecs this week. You know, we dip into Doctor Who on the iPlayer and it's still a me and him thing. And I'm sure now we've reached a certain age, both of us, that will continue on and on and on. We will now always have that as a shared family experience and a bonding experience between the two of us. And he will still go on walks with me and tell me exactly why I'm wrong to hold all the opinions that I hold about Doctor Who. And be right. He's right.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That family circle has absolutely occurred. Wonderful person to share it with, really. Mm-hmm. So now I'm Simon, at a what next stage in my world, which is my kids.
So where do you go now?
Yeah, well, my kids are definitely not going to stay at home forever, although
no,
that still seems to be open to negotiation. I've started saying yes to things, Simon. I heard David the other week saying how he started to say yes to things, and that's been common for a couple of your callers. So the Lego stuff, eventually, you know, I've been building a few years before, at some point during lockdown, I started the Brick Pandorica account on Twitter and Instagram and just kept posting and posting and posting. And people were generally, you know, the fear around social media is at some point somebody's going to be utterly horrible to you in a absolutely succinct and ruthless way, and you're never going to want to get out of bed ever again. And amazingly, over the last 3 years or so, perhaps because Lego Doctor Who is so absurdly whimsical and clearly doesn't matter in any way, shape or form, I've had none of that. I've just had generally people catching on to it and being really positive and not nitpicky, and that continued to encourage me and fuel my ego in terms of what I'm doing. But that's flowed through to being a little more active in the Lego community locally. I've talked about doing shows, which are wonderful because sometimes you hit that Venn diagram where the child in front of you doesn't just like Lego, but they really like Doctor Who, and they clicked that everything on this table is Doctor Who, and you see their eyes light up, and that's perfect. I got a confession off a bloke that he had spent a COVID recovery watching Warriors Gate, so there are slightly more people to that Venn diagram than perhaps I initially thought. So I've been saying yes to that. I did not just this podcast, but I said yes to the Something Who podcast, which I did a couple of guest appearances on. The first one of those, we did Image of the Fendal earlier this year, and Richard, Paul and Giles, who are the regular core group that do that, were wonderful, wonderfully supportive when I joined the call, and we had a great chat. It did at one point finally dawn on me that actually this had been recorded and would be released to the general public, which was a bit of a during the break between the two stories that we were talking about, Paul and I were on our own on the Teams call, and Paul said, "So is this the first podcast that you've done?" And I said, "Yeah, Paul, yeah, first podcast I've done. I've been saving myself for you." And he looked at me and nodded and thought, "My God, we let her write first timer on our podcast." Mm-hmm. What I didn't tell him was that podcast was the first time I talked to another grown-up about Doctor Who for any longer than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That was, you know, I've just said, talked to my son William a lot about Doctor Who. Occasionally seen people at things like Thought Bubble, Comic Convention locally, and talk to them for a few minutes on about Doctor Who, but nothing that scratched the surface on what this show was or what I felt about it or what I would say about it. So I properly broke the seal that day in terms of saying, right, I'm just going to talk. We'll see what happens. And I would do it under the high stakes of it being recorded forever and ever and ever and ever.
If you're going to do these things, you might as well do it in the biggest and loudest possible way you can.
I mean, potentially, yes. And one, now that the seal is broken, Si, as this illustrates, I may just not stop talking.
No.
Somebody may just simply need to take me to a vet's and put me down soon, because I have simply just not stopped telling anyone, anywhere, under any circumstances, about what I think about the show.
This is what happens. It's happened to us all. When I did my first podcast, I was very nervous and thought, I don't have very much to say. And then thought, well, no, of course I do. I'm a Doctor Who fan. I know this stuff is just in my head and it's all going to come pouring out. And it did, and it hasn't stopped since.
Yeah, it's like it's like wandering down a street and seeing somebody suddenly start ranting. It's like it's an epiphany moment that I can have conversations about this. I don't need to spend my life down the pub every week talking absolute rubbish about football, because that's what my general friendship group do and serve me very well in that regard. There are other hobbies and obsessions that I'm now prepared to move out of that solitary, self-imposed solitary confinement and start to engage people about. And doing the Lego builds and the Brick Pandorica piece has kind of given me a role or a thing in which to feel that I can express those views rather than just being an absolute random stranger. I feel like I'm offering some form of collateral of whimsical entertainment alongside some of those thoughts. But nevertheless, you know, the thoughts are coming and I'm starting to say yes to things. And I even, a couple of weeks ago, attended a meeting of the Yorkshire Whovians.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's a big step forward.
It was. It was a bit of a smash and grab. They were watching The Demons, Power of the Doctor, which I don't think they do watches very much. I think it's just generally a coffee and a chat. And one way or another, I've been trying to do it for a couple of months and the dates and timings, life was just getting in the way. And I literally knew I had a window where I could get into Leeds, watch The Demons and escape out again. So I kind of just, under the cover of darkness, turned up in the basement of this pub, sat and watched 5 episodes of Doctor Who with other grown-ups, which, again, was a real rarity. Said hello to people, apologised mostly for the fact that it looked like I was only here for the watching of The Demons, and I scurried home again. But nobody got hurt. I felt good about it. They all looked like reasonable cross-sectional human beings. And who knows if my timings and diary align, I'd love to get back there and you know, that's a next step, mm-hmm. stage of what do I do with this as a hobby. Lego shows, maybe a podcast if I'm asked, actually meeting real people.
Wow. So I just have one more question to ask you.
Yes.
When are you building the Viewmaster first shot of the Doctor, Romana and K9 in the console room?
Well, I imagine, and this is the advantage of having been building to a unnatural extent, is I have a TARDIS interior. I have a Romana in her red top.
Okay.
I think that would have been the one I remember in my mind. I certainly have a little K9. Yeah. And I have a fourth Doctor. I could put that together for you, Si, and we could accompany our podcast with a picture of that.
Well, I think that's a great deal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There were far more awkward scenes from Doctor Who that would have left me thinking, my God, how much is that going to cost me on Bricklink to buy the pieces necessary?
I could do an easy one. That's fine.
that's tremendous. It was almost like we planned that. And I will make it happen.
Fabulous. I think it's fair to say that Doctor Who's had a big impact on your life and is now having a changing impact on your life.
Yes, I'm not sure I would go as far as saying it has evolved, but it has changed as as my life has progressed. It's always been there in one form or another. It's always been there on my terms up until having a family in which I needed to then start sharing it. And now, you know, I'm experimenting with sharing it even more broadly. Mm-hmm. And that's a great thing. It means it will stand in good stead, I think, my fandom and my obsession for many, many years to come.
I think you're on safe ground there, Richard. So I'd like to say thank you very much for your time and for your wonderful story that, again, is the same and different to every other fan. And it's been really great to hear, especially the bonding with your son, which I think was just sounded magical and really wonderful thing.
Excellent. I tell you, it's been a real pleasure. If you don't mind, I'm going to spend a few more hours wandering around the library looking at 10th anniversary magazines and that curious painting that
yes.
got donated to your library. That was a good story, that one. But it's been a pleasure. And Simon, you know, you've been very welcoming. It's fantastic to finally meet you. I love the podcast.
And you too.
And may there be many more episodes to come.
Oh, I'm sure there will be. So I will place the Brick Pandorica very carefully next to some off-air Doctor Who videos from Australia, thanks to Brendan. And just want to say thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Richard, for coming along. And hopefully you'll join us next time when there'll be someone else coming to the library with an object and their story. So thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.